you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and our pal and my boss, Dan Greenfield, is back. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Rob.
Sure. Of course, as everybody knows by now from Dan's previous episodes, if Dan is on the show, that means we're talking about one thing. Rudolph Summer Fun. Yes.
Yes.
Rudolph Summer Fun. No, I'm kidding, of course. We're talking about Batman. And in this case, it's Famous First Edition, numbers F5, Batman number one. And there's a whole bunch of fun little details to get into this particular issue of Famous First Edition. Before we get to all that, so Dan, why this one? Did you have this one as a kid?
Yes, I did. It was one of the three treasuries, and we've already talked about the other two, the C-37, the Villains issue, and the Ra's al Ghul C-51. For me, this was the triumvirate of treasuries. These were the ones you had to have. The other ones are fine. They're good. I never had them. I saw them as adults, and I realized, okay, they were fine. But the three that I did have were, like, in sum, you know, practically the Batman Bible. I don't remember when I got this. I did get it, like, when it came out, roughly. And it came out, pub dated February, March 1975. So I would have been about 8 years old when it came out. And I don't know if it was a present or any. I just remember having it. And I remember just opening up and actually being confused that it had two covers, which I know that we'll get into.
Right.
That was a little bit. Then, you know, it took some time. Then I figured out what was going on. But I love this comic book, and the thing that is amazing is that even with all of the changes that Batman had already gone through by the mid 70s, it holds up wonderfully. It had, I mean, as a young kid, you know, 7 or 8 years old, it was a page turner. And of course, as an adult, it still holds up as a great comic book. It is, in my mind, one of the absolute greatest single issues of comics ever produced.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, not only is it Batman number one, which, of course, by itself, that's significant, but it features the first appearance of two of his biggest villains. I mean, this thing is just, it's making history left and right. And it's interesting, you mentioned about the two covers. Yeah, it is a little confusing if you're a kid and you don't really feel understand what you're looking at, because, of course, the outside cover has got a reproduction of Batman number one on the cover, and it's got the header. And then after the intro by Corman Infantino, then there is the full color, the full treasury size reproduction of the cover. So yeah, you do get two covers, and it took a little, like, for many years when I was a kid, you would find these Famous First Editions with the outer covering removed.
Yeah.
And then sometimes disreputable dealers would try and sell, like, oh, this is Batman number one. That's just how big comics were in 1940.
Right.
You're like, oh, okay, you know, whatever. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting format to try that they would even reproduce the ads. You know, it is literally a letter perfect. I mean, we've talked about in other episodes, like the Wiz Comics number two, there are some alterations made because of legal things with Shazam and stuff. But this is, as far as I know, an exact replica of what Batman number one looked like, except for the size.
Yeah, even to the point where inside the bottom cover in the back, there's an important notice that explains the fact, don't try sending away for that $2 phonograph, kids. You know, don't try it, you know, because it's all, this is, we're just reproducing it exactly as it was, but these ads are no longer relevant. It is beautiful. And what's great about the cover is that this Bob Kane, Jerry Robinson cover is so striking. And so that when you do open the outer cover that says, you know, Famous First Edition, Limited Collector's Silver Mint Series, and you open it up, and then it just, that bright yellow with the big Batman and Robin figures, it just pops right out at you. Yeah. It's just gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous.
It's thoroughly unmysterious when you think about it. I mean, the bright yellow and the red silhouette of the city. But nevertheless, it's just so noticeable. And, of course, Robin's cape is colored incorrectly. But, I mean, you know, they were like, oh, what the hell? This is early. Kids aren't paying attention to this stuff.
Well, it's not only was it green, but his hair was brown, which mm-hmm. was also, you know, they miscolored his hair, too, because inside it's black. But it also, I mean, these are those early tonal shifts that you saw, because this was, you know, it was the previous Batman issue that had been put out was Detective number 38. So Robin is brand new. I mean, right. this is basically his first. This is Robin year one is what right. this is, you know. And so in addition to the Joker, in addition to the Catwoman, or as they call her, the Cat, and some other elements of the you know, of the Batman of Batman's world, not to mention even Hugo Strange, which we'll get to, you are seeing that kind of slight tonal shift away from the noir right on the cover, even though inside the stories do still kind of hew to that film noir kind of concept in a very big way.
Yeah, yeah. So the inside, there's an editorial by Carmine Infantino, who actually spends a good amount of copy space crediting Bill Finger. It's funny that, you know, Bill Finger became so famous for being the guy that got shut out of the creations. And, of course, he died fairly early and he never saw any of the money. But nevertheless, Carmine here really does give Bill Finger a lot of credit.
It's actually startling to read it now. As a kid, I probably just ignored it because I don't remember ever having read it. But as an adult, you read it, and he lays out exactly what Bill Finger's, even to the point of making the point that they met at Poe Park, which just a few months ago, the street outside of Poe Park in the Bronx was renamed Bill Finger Way. Mm. And he, you know, makes this point really that it was Bill Finger that contributed all of these things, and that basically Bob he doesn't call Bob Kane a fraud. But he practically said, he without saying it, he says it. Now, my understanding is also that Carmine Infantino and Bob Kane were not exactly buddy-buddy, and that it was, I believe, that it was under Infantino's watch that Kane ultimately left DC in the late 60s when his contract was up, and then they decided to bring in other artists. Remember, because Infantino had been doing, you know, it was Infantino and Moldoff in the 60s who were doing, you know, the Batman art and the interiors, and Infantino was doing all those covers all through the new look and into the late 60s. And then Infantino became an executive. And I think Kane's departure was – I think he, after the show had become so successful, he tried to hold up DC for more money, and Infantino basically told him to take a hike. I'm fairly certain that's the story, and I'm sure that your readers will correct us if I'm wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure that's it. So it looks like, you know, Infantino or whoever may have ghostwritten this piece, you know, I don't know if Infantino actually wrote this or whether it was someone on staff who wrote it and Infantino put his name on it.
E. Nelson Bridwell.
right. Or, you know, I don't know if Paul Levitz was around yet. I think he was. That's another person who could have easily done this. But it's a well-written piece, too, and it really does basically lay out there. And this is also just goes to show you that the DC lawyers really weren't paying attention because it's pretty remarkable that they basically say, yeah, Batman was more or less created whole cloth by Bill Finger, and here are all the changes that he made, and here's what he did. And now, of course, it took yet another, another 40 years or so for Bill Finger to finally get his name in the comic books.
Kids, if you like Bill, if you like Batman, and we presume you do because you're buying this, Bill Finger's the reason. It's remarkable when you go back and read this stuff. So as we talked about, this book reproduces the ads, of course, and on the inside cover it says, "Boys, you can get a G-Man outfit with a lie detector." I mean, as we all know, nobody wants to be in the FBI nowadays because it's riddled with corruption. We know all that. Can't trust it.
It's a vast left-wing conspiracy.
It is a vast,
the FBI.
Melvin Purvis, famous lefty. Anyway, let's move on before I get angry emails.
J. Edgar Hoover.
Yeah, famous lefty, J. Edgar Hoover. So anyway, all the stories, unless noted, are by Bill Finger and Bob Kane. The first one is not titled, although on Mike's Amazing World, it's simply called The Joker, although the opening page here is the origin story. It says the legend of Batman, of who he came to be. So the first two pages are just a reproduction of the origin sequence with the whole I should become a bat and my parents are dead, the whole bit. So There's that. It's a nice little, you know, reminder of everybody who this is. So, again, the first story is called The Joker, and it's a criminal known as The Joker announces his crimes over the radio, threatening to kill several men and steal valuable items from them. When he is successful, the underworld is angry that he has upstaged them. Brute Nelson, great name, a gangster, plans a trap for the Joker, but the Joker avoids it by killing Nelson. Batman, having taken interest in the case, is nearly killed himself when he attempts to pursue the clown prince of crime. I love these early Joker stories because he is so... I mean, the Joker's always been creepy looking, but he's like kind of extra creepy looking because he looks like a corpse in all these stories, the way his eyes are drawn. I mean, he's just like... He looks more... Less... Just more like... I mean, he looks very gangstery, which is so much not something they followed up with later on. As he got more cartoony looking, here he kind of looks like a gangster who just has this weird face paint.
Yeah, I mean, he's got the fedora, he's got the outfit. Although he does have the string tie, but yeah, he's got the big, you know, the dark circles under his eyes. I think it's kind of funny that the first time they reference him, they say his a man with a changeless mask like face. But for the eyes, burning hate-filled eyes. But yet you see him, and his face changes. He actually does frown. He smiles. It's not the Joker that sometimes got portrayed later with just the grin slapped on his face that is always there. He actually emotes, to coin a phrase. But the thing is, again, it's still the Joker. He's got the widow's peak. He's got the hair. What amazes me about this issue in general, and the Joker in particular, is how much they got right off the bat. Because in a lot of these early Golden Age stories, you see the beginnings of something that later became something else. Superman, I think, is actually a great example because Superman changed radically from his beginnings to what he ultimately became. The Joker, even though he kind of had a wayward path, ultimately came full circle. And this Joker is not all that far off from where he is today. Yeah, they've made him crazier. Yeah, they've made him more of a maniac. But he's still a homicidal maniac here. And he's also really, really, really compelling. I also love his hideout. I love the big tiger rug and the gigantic smiling clown face above his desk.
Oh yeah, he's got a great hangout. There's no the Baroque chair that he's sitting in, and the way I like that one panel where he's like he's doing like the Mr. Burns where he's like putting his fingers together and he's all like excellent. Yes. He looks older. I think that was something I was trying to suggest. He looks older. Yeah. He looks like he's probably in his 50s or 60s as opposed to Batman, who is very young here. But he just has a more just a seedier look to him, which I like. And of course, he's got that cool purple pork pie hat that he's wearing on, like the white room. He looks very dashing, you know? It's really cool. And he said they knew what they had, obviously, because the Joker returns in this very comic book.
Exactly.
So the second feature is a short humor strip called Major Bigsby and Bots by Paul Gustafson. This is something that they like to old comics put this stuff in there, I guess, either for the sake of variety or maybe because they had a couple extra pages and they could just slot this stuff in. So it tonally, it completely doesn't fit with Batman because it's like it's got like Western stuff. And so you're like, what is this doing in my comic? And I remember being a kid reading these, like, why is this here? Like, I don't understand. Why is this in my comic book?
I it would be more forgivable if it were at least funny. But it's not funny at all. I mean, I'm sorry, Paul Gustafson. I am, and your descendants. It's just not funny. I'm just like waiting for the gag, and there's no gag. And I guess the idea is that it's supposed to be this kind of well-to-do, or you know, this and this. I don't know. It's sort of like a man about town and his cowboy friend or something. It's all very strange. I don't know. Whatever.
once again, the Gustafson family cries itself to sleep because nobody. Yeah. their grandfather did. So the next story, again untitled, but generally it's called Professor Hugo Strange and the Monsters, which sounds like a great ska band that nobody's ever got to say. But I forgot to mention that, of course, Hugo Strange makes his debut. Not his debut. That's
right. It's his last appearance before Englehart and Rogers got their hands on him in the 70s.
Is it really?
Yeah. This was the last time he'd been seen.
Wow.
He was basically Batman's big bad villain. He and the Monk were the bad villains until the Joker came along. So basically, for the first year, from 39 to 40, before Batman #1 premiered, That's what also makes this interesting is that it's kind of a passing of the baton, this issue. Hugo Strange is kind of the last of those golden age, you know, more classic pulpy, evil scientists, you know, weird vampire type characters that he went up against. More or less, this was the end of this with this story. And yet elements of the whole Hugo Strange shtick, again, are right here and that have been lifted, you know, numerous times. You know, again, Engelhardt and Rogers used the whole Monster Man. Well, give the yeah, recap, yeah, and then I'll, yeah.
Yeah, the Hugo Strange escapes from prison and also kidnaps several lunatics from an insane asylum.
Yeah.
Later, a monstrous giant stalks the streets causing trouble, and Batman suspects that Strange is responsible. Good call. The Cape Crusader is quickly defeated and brought in Strange's hideout, where he's injected with a serum that will turn him into a monster. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the more... I mean, Hugo Strange is definitely more of a sci-fi thing, because this monster that's running amok in Gotham City is like 20... It's like two stories high. I mean, he's not Frankenstein. He's a good 20 to 30 feet. I mean, this is like... he picks up a car at one point, and it's like Godzilla size. It's crazy.
Well, King Kong size.
King Kong size, yeah. Yeah, have more appropriate reference, King Kong size. And I love within this story, we get Batman in his bat plane with his machine gun. Which is great. This is, you know, an early version of Batman that he was doing that to people. This has one of the panel that you've seen later reproduced, where it's him with the machine gun. Right. And he's like, much as I hate to take human life, I'm afraid this time it's necessary.
Yeah. He doesn't really show much remorse. I mean, on the next page, he basically hangs off of the Batcave. He hangs one of the monsters by his neck, and then he dies, and he says, he's probably better off this way. just basically assuaging his own guilt, you know?
The operative word there is probably.
Yeah, probably better off that way. Yeah, I mean, he's going into – and also, by the way, this is also one of those things from early Batman. They actually make the point that it's not Gotham City. It's lower Manhattan. So he's actually in New York City when he does this. I mean, the big opening splash looks like Times Square, and that's fine, whatever. But it actually says here, a month later, a crowded street in lower Manhattan. And so there's all sorts of mayhem there, too. So, again, they were mixing certain things. I mean, I guess the L was the second, third Avenue L, was it? I don't remember. I'd have to check my history books. I should know but that off the top of my head. But, yeah, the whole thing kind of, you know, the climax, of course, is your classic, you know, King Kong, you know. It's basically this whole thing feels like it was an exercise to give Batman an opportunity to do King Kong.
I never realized that Hugo Strange did not make another appearance for 35 years. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Engelhardt apparently went back when he got his hands on doing Batman in the 70s. He'd brought over from Marvel to do Justice League. And he said, look, if I come over, I also want to do Batman. They said, okay, good, do Batman. And he went back into the DC library and was kind of looking through stuff. And he said that he wanted to bring that pulp part of Batman, and obviously this was one of the stories that he seized on, because those famous Engelhardt Rogers issues is basically actually the Joker story and the Hugo Strange stories are in a fashion remakes of these Batman number one stories, where in the Joker story, the Joker doing the I'm gonna, you know, announcing to the world I'm gonna kill someone, and then finding a really creative, elaborate way to do it. Even though these people are being protected by the cops and they set up a cordon around all these people, he manages to do it. Then you've got the whole Hugo Strange thing where he's creating monster men. You know, as you know, in the later version, it's wealthy, you know, people who come to this this kind of spa that he runs, and he turns them into monster men. And then Matt Wagner, years later, about 20 years later, also did Batman and the Monster Men, which was supposed to take place after year one, where, again, he kind of modernizes the story and has Batman versus Hugo Strange. But, yeah, Hugo Strange was off the map from 1940 to, like, 1977.
That's amazing. I had no idea. I knew that he was gone for a long time, but I didn't know it was that complete. That is remarkable. Wow, that's cool. Yeah, I mean, I always really like Hugo Strange. I thought he was actually one of the cool – the Engelhardt Rogers story with him is great. The ghost, where that opening page, that one page where, what's his name, Boss Thorne goes – I know we're getting off this book a little, but when Boss Thorne is driving out into the night and he sees the ghost of Hugo Strange hitchhiking and the Hugo Strange leaps into the front passenger seat and strangles him, that terrified me when I was a little kid. because it was just something, scary. The way it was so wordlessly done, it was like, oh my God, it was great. So yeah, I always thought Hugo Strange, like the Scarecrow, was one of those kind of underserved villains. And of course, he's never been in any of the, I mean, he's on Gotham, the TV show, but he's never been in any of the movies yet, I guess because he just doesn't have a hook necessarily. Although you could have a guy that creates monsters, that'd be kind of a fun thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and again, not to get too far off, but it's been a while since I've been on the show. You know, I know you like to ask people what treasuries do they think that they would have been great. Engelhard Rogers, that run as a treasury. Man.
Oh, that would be beautiful.
Just imagine seeing that artwork by Marshall Rogers at the in the blown up size with the way the cape flows, but even more importantly, the architecture of the city.
Oh, boy, yeah.
And those page layouts and the way that he would draw the Joker. That one famous panel, it's a left-hand panel that goes from the top of the page to the bottom where his ha-ha-ha-ha-ha is kind of swirling around his body.
Yep.
Just being – that would have been great. But anyway, back to that.
Yeah, that is beautiful. That is beautiful.
Yeah.
So that's Hugo Strange and the Monsters. Next up, there's a one-page little mystery text piece called Strictly Publicity, which is kind of fun. At least thematically, it fits in better with Batman because it's about a detective. So that's kind of a nice little thing. Next up, there's another one-page text feature, Meet the Artist. And it's a profile of Bob Kane. Bob knew, man. He knew marketing early on. I mean, one of the things you got to say about him – He knew how to do this when Siegel and Schuster did not, you know.
No.
I mean, he figured this is. I mean, he managed to live off Batman the rest of his life as opposed to Siegel and Schuster. I mean, he was smart that way. So here he is, it's him at his drawing table. I'm guessing copying over somebody else's work, and he's talking about, you know, all the different things that he worked on before Batman, and it's a great If Bob Kane had been alive today, he'd be totally on Twitter and Snapchat. He'd be like the master of social media.
He would. And what's interesting, when you read the piece, a couple things jumped at me. One, he was 24 years old at the time. So think about, you know, being all of that, everything that you just said, and he's only 24. But also it works it kind of puts the Carmine Infantino editorial inside, you know, the inside cover of this thing into sharper relief, because this entire page is basically – you know, everybody should be on their knees to Bob Kane and what a brilliant creator he is. There's no mention of Jerry Robinson, whose artwork is all over this book. There's no mention of Bill Finger, who's writing the stories. There's no mention of anything other than what a hard worker Bob Kane is. So it's a nice bit of 1940 propaganda for you.
He's at his drawing board 7 days a week, it says here. So
yes, it does. Yes.
Sure.
Collecting his money, I think.
Yeah. Bob Kane cashes checks up to 7 days a week. Good for. I mean, we're making fun of him, but it was. He was smart enough to know
credit where credit's due, man.
Yeah,
I mean, this is America.
He knew he created something. He had gold. He struck gold, and he knew enough to be able to live off it. God bless him. Right. I mean, again, I don't credit him for pushing other people out the door, but.
No.
I mean, Siegel and Schuster had to lived very penurious lives up until Neil Adams and Jules Feiffer got them a modest stipend for their creation, and that's a shame. Anyone who creates Superman should be rich. You know, again, we're getting off field a little, but like I think about like when Lynn Wein passed away last year, right?
Yeah.
And I never found this out or because it's not any of my business, but it's like to me, Lynn Wein created Wolverine. He should have been rich the rest of his life because he created Wolverine. They made, they're making multi-million-dollar movies based on a character he created. Lynn Wein should have been living in a giant, like, Wolverine-shaped house, you know?
Wolverine-shaped house.
That's how it should work. If you create something of that value. So all credit to Bob Kane. He knew to get his name out there early and sign his name to everything because that's how it was going to work. And it did. It did work that way. So,
and to be fair, that wasn't all that uncommon at the time either. I mean, there were ghosts and having studios that you basically were the name of the studio and you hire these people to do the ghost work. That wasn't all that uncommon.
Right.
It's just that if you're looking back in, you know, hindsight being 2020, it makes him out to be a real charlatan. And perhaps he was. But I do think that you also have to look at it in the context of the time. And like you say, you got to give him credit for seeing what he had and cashing in on where tons of these other guys and the vast majority of the Golden Age guys got, comparably speaking, got virtually nothing.
Yeah.
Of course, everybody even talks about, you know, Jack Kirby. You know, and again, I know we're getting way off, But and we can go on that in a whole separate podcast. But yeah, you do have to at least say, yeah, well, you know, at least he knew what he had.
Yeah, he knew the value of what he created. So, and there's some great stuff here. All these stories are fun. So the next one is The Cat, which of course will become the Catwoman eventually. Robin goes undercover aboard a boat to protect a valuable necklace of Miss Martha Travers. When the necklace goes missing, there are several suspects. Before any suspects can be questioned, several thieves board the boat to steal the necklace. With it already stolen, they begin search the passengers. Robin takes on the thieves with the help of Batman, who arrives late. Robin tells Batman about the suspects, as well as someone known as the Cat. The beautiful thief offers Batman a partnership, which he turns down, but she escapes from them thanks to Batman's blundering. Robin suspects that his partner may have intentionally allowed her to get away. They had this formula right from the very beginning, and that the idea that Batman and the Catwoman are, you know, their relationship is a little more warm than the typical superhero-supervillain relationship. And, of course, that's something they traded on in the TV series and up until... I mean, it right from the very first appearance, it's established that Batman kind of likes Catwoman.
The things... In addition to everything you just said, there's more to it than that in my mind also, is that this is, for the first half of the story, a Robin solo story.
Right.
So they also knew what they had with this character right away. They show him to be funny, capable... you know, intelligent, all of the things that Robin became known for, they're hitting the ground running with this character. What I like about it also is that it feels almost like a Charlie Chan movie. You know, it's like Robin and the, you know, Robin and the whatever Ruby or whatever it is. And so for the first, you know, he's on the high seas, he's wearing a tuxedo, he's acting as a cabin boy or whatever it is, a steward. And there's this mystery, who stole the thing, and then these criminals come on board, and then you get into this idea that, and even they think that the Cat might be a man for a while, and then it's at the very end that we see that, no, it's Catwoman, who she later becomes, and Batman is taken with her immediately. What's also really cool about this, yeah, obviously Batman lets her get away. This is all on purpose. He even says, you know, I still have a girl named Julie, who is Julie Madison, who they eventually did forget about, but... What is also neat about this, and if any of your listeners who are also reading Batman today, Tom King, the writer on Batman, has used this story as, you know, as subtext for the current relationship with Batman and Catwoman. You know, Batman and Catwoman are engaged to be married now in the modern comics. The wedding is supposed to be this summer, and there's been a back and forth about who's their first meet cute. Was it this story, which is the way Batman remembers it, the more romantic version, or is it the Batman Year One really harsh version, and that's the way Selina Kyle remembers it? And they're always arguing. The first time I met you was on that boat. No, the first time I met you was on the street. You were in disguise. No, you were in disguise. And it's really, really cute the way he does it, but also as a nice payoff, you know, nearly 80 years later, that diamond that she had stolen, he actually uses that diamond for her engagement ring. So, yeah, it's really great. I highly recommend any Batman fans to read that modern take because Tom King gets it. Anyway.
There are two panels in the story that are particularly, to me, noteworthy. One is kind of famous in meme circles, and then there's another one that isn't. The first one is, of course... When Batman is grabbing Catwoman and she says, "Let go of me," and he says, "Quiet or Papa Spank," which is
so awful.
Fantastic. Batman was just like, okay. And then later on, that same page, he wants to check her bandage that she has on her ankle. And he said, "Well, Cat, it seems we've got you at last. Now let's take a look at that bandage." And she says, "What's the use? I know when I'm licked. Go ahead." And look, this is very crude artwork, of course. And so there's not a lot of inference you can take from this because, you know, I just don't think it's meant to. But nevertheless, the pose that Bob Kane gives Catwoman, she is giving herself she's setting up a pose which really does suggest that she is pretty into Batman.
It is very suggestive. there's no question about it. It is also the double entendre, "I know when I'm licked."
Yeah.
Ooh. I mean, come on. Yeah. Now, these guys were like, well, Bob Kane was a 24-year-old man.
As we know, Bill Finger
was about, you know, roughly the same age. I mean, of course, these guys used to do this sort of stuff all the time. And then in the next panel, of course, you see an even closer up you know, closer look of her skirt above the knee. I mean, it's definitely meant to be suggestive. Yeah. But again, that goes to the whole Batman Catwoman thing. And also, even he says to her, look, or when she says to him, look, we could be the king and queen of crime. And he says, your proposition tempts me, but we work on different sides of the law. Let's go. Which, of course, is like, that's the classic Julie Newmar, Adam West, back and forth also.
Yeah. And I love the last panel, the inset of the two of them in the car. And Batman is sitting, he says, lovely girl, what eyes. Say, mustn't forget I've got a girl named Julie. Oh, well, she still had lovely eyes. Maybe I'll bump into her again sometime. And he's got his finger to his chin. And he's like,
And then Robin, he's got a grin on his face.
Yeah, he's got
too.
A grin, and Robin's going, I like these stories, these early stories, I mean, pretty much well into the Marvel era of comics, there really was not a lot of characterization. These were pretty much kind of stock guys. But I like this little bit of business. You know, that Robin's like, oh boy, you know, I think it's funny. It's cute.
Yeah, it is good. The other thing, just as a quick aside in terms of favorite panels, one of my favorite panels is earlier in the story when Robin punches out one of the thugs and he hits him so hard that his hat pops off his head. And it's just a great uppercut shot. And it's just, again, it's one of those great – I just wanted to mention that before we moved on. But, yeah, the interplay between Batman and Robin – Batman and Catwoman, the Joker earlier, and as we're about to see the Joker again, there's so much in this comic book that they got right in Batman number one. You can't forget that. This was Batman number one, even though it wasn't Detective 27. You know, all of that, that first year of Batman, I always thought of as a shakeout cruise, but that the real modern Batman started with this issue, that everything started to crystallize here. And then everything goes from there.
They figured it out pretty early on. So there's an ad for a DC House ad talking about all the other titles they publish: Action, Adventure, Detective, All American, More Fun, and Flash. And it's kind of interesting that they sort of present these titles as the house titles for these individual characters. I mean, it's like Action starring Superman, Adventure starring the Sandman, Detective starring Batman, All American starring Ultraman. That would change pretty quickly. More Fun starring the Spectre, and Flash starring the Flash. It was DC was full of these omnibus anthology titles, and yet they were, you know, they were definitely going out of their way to present, you know, this is the main character. This is why you're buying. This is why you're plunking down your 10 cents for Adventure Comics, is to get the Sandman. So, I think that's kind of neat. And I love all these old timey books. I mean, DC brought them back for that event where they brought Sensation back in Adventure. I love all that kind of stuff. It's really cool.
I like that they call it the Big Six. So they're again establishing that it's a line of comics, that these are the ones that you have to get them all, and the dates on them, you know, on sale about the 15th of every month. But I used to just stare at this page when I was a kid. I was just entranced by it. And even to this day, I look at Ultraman and I'm like, okay, first off, he looks like Adam Strange. But the other thing is, who's Ultraman?
Yeah.
I mean, I know you really have to be a hardcore comics fan to know who Ultraman is.
Yeah.
Because the other five all went on to have, you know, to different degrees, you know, at least well-known comics careers.
Sure.
You know, the Sandman and the Spectre falling behind the Flash, of course, and the Flash ultimately getting replaced by Barry Allen later on. But Ultraman kind of just went nowhere.
But still,
5 out of 6 isn't bad.
Well, I think it's like a month or two later, they would introduce Green Lantern into the book, and then they knew, now we got another big star here. So there's another text piece, an aviation one called Two Aces by George Shute. Then there's another humor page called Ginger Snap, and it's weird. On Mike's Amazing World credits this to Bob Kane, but here the signature is Ted Ray. So I'm not exactly sure who did it, whether this is Bob Kane working in a different style or what, or maybe Mike's Amazing World is just simply wrong. I don't know.
No, according to the comics, the Grand Comics database, it says Bob Kane wrote it as Ted Ray.
Oh, okay.
It's entirely possible that I guess he did it because he didn't. Not to confuse the readers, because Batman, you know, now, again, he was probably shrewd enough to understand Batman is, you know, I'm branding here. You know, Batman is Bob Kane, Bob Kane is Batman. But if I'm going to do this other stuff and collect another paycheck, I'll do this under a different name, and it's good filler, and now I've been paid for another 2 pages.
Okay, that's important in this Depression-era America.
And compared to the other humor strip, this one actually is kind of funnier.
Yeah, it's like a little Lulu, little Iodine kind of, you know, Nancy Sleno sort of strip to it. There's a one-page feature called Fantastic Facts, which is just sort of random things that you can learn about the Ripley's Believe It or Not kind of thing about Jack Dempsey's fist goes 135 miles an hour when he punches somebody. Yeah. So it's those little things you can learn. And then the final story is the Joker returns. Again, they were so they knew what they had from the very beginning. They brought Joker back in the very, very same comic. And at the opening splash page, I love that Joker is whacking at a flagpole that Robin is dangling off of with an axe, which is just terrific. I love that. So in this story, the Joker escapes jail using an explosive hidden inside his tooth. He He continues his string of jewel thefts and strange killings. Batman encounters him at one such robbery, but the Harlequin of Hate gets the best of him. Batman recovers before the police can remove his mask, but the Joker has already escaped. Batman then plants a trap for the Joker by baiting him to steal a priceless ruby, as we know Joker cannot resist that. The Joker shows up and tangles with the dynamic duo. While struggling with Batman, the Joker is stabbed by his own knife and left for dead by the Caped Crusaders. The police find the body, and the doctor determines that the Joker lives on. Because of course he does. Bob Kane and Bill Finger knew this is the second greatest thing we've created. There's no way we're getting rid of this guy.
Well, it was. It might have been the story on this one is that because I think the editor on the book was Whitney Ellsworth, that it was apparently Ellsworth and others at DC or at National as it was called at the time were the ones who made that call. That the original story was that the Joker was supposed to die, and of course this was a you see the body kind of death too, not him falling into the sea.
Right, and it happened to Dick Tracy all the time. They were constantly killing people, killing the bad guys off.
Exactly. And they figured, no, that's, you know, so they apparently redrew that last panel.
Oh, really?
Where the where the doctor said, he's going to live. And you know, the cops says, look, what's the matter, Doc? You look as if you'd seen a ghost. I might have. I just examined this man. He isn't dead. He's still alive, and he's going to live. And, of course, then he did live again and continues and now is, you know, comic book's greatest villain. So, yeah, I mean, somebody had the presence of mind to say, no, I don't think we want to get rid of this. And it really is true because you look throughout the two stories as a whole, there are so many Joker tropes that are still used today. And, yes, again, they were forgotten along the way in some respects because he changed with the times and then ultimately circled back in the 70s. But you have the announcing his crime before he does it and then coming up with a really creative, unexpected way. Like in this second story, he kills this police chief because he sets up a dart in the phone receiver that when he yells his name, the Joker, the vibrations shoot the dart into his ear and the venom kills him, which is great, completely implausible but wonderful. The use of the Joker card, you know, that his calling card, you know, him something that also often got left – isn't used that often, but you did see it actually in the movie The Dark Knight, him being a quote-unquote master of disguise, because in the first Joker story here, you see him dressed up as a police chief, and he's got this grin on his face when you see that he's disguised as this police chief. It's very similar to the look that Heath Ledger has in The Dark Knight when he's dressed up as a cop on the street,
right?
And he's got kind of like this really ghoulish grin. But all, you know, it's also violent. He goes after Batman with a battle axe. And you also get those last vestiges of Batman still being chased by the cops, which was something also that was of its time and something that was eventually when he became the quote-unquote duly deputized agent of the law. There are still references to here that the cops are after Batman because at the end of this Joker story, the cops shoot at him. They're like, Batman is like, I got to get out of here. And they're still shooting at him. So they're still mixing, you know, a lot of those early Golden Age tropes with things that would become you know, more established later. And again, I can't say it enough because I love Robin. I think Robin is such a great character, and he really does shine throughout all of the stories that he's in this book. The Hugo Strange story he's not in because originally that story was supposed to be in Detective 38. And, of course, famously, Detective 38 was Robin's, you know, premiere.
Right.
So they had the spot for the, you know, for the story here. So they tucked that story in, and then from this point forward – it was Batman and Robin until the end of 1969. Right. Although Robin, of course, did also have his own, you know, he had his own solo strip in Star Spangled Comics, you know, about 10 years after this or thereabouts, 9 years later, I guess.
It's funny you mentioned the Hugo Strange story is supposed to run in a different book because you got to wonder if this story wasn't supposed to run in Detective Comics because right after this story, there's an ad for Detective Comics number 40, and on the cover is a guy whacking at a flagpole with an axe that Robin is dangling off of. Now, it's not the Joker, But it's you could just be colored. It was just probably just miscolored. But it looks right. like the opening splash to this very story. So you
I always
wonder
wondered
if,
this.
Yeah, well, they didn't mean to put it there, and then they decided, oh, you know what? Let's just slot it in the back of Batman number one.
I wondered the same thing because it is he's got him on the flagpole again with the green cape, but you look at the drawing of the guy with the axe. And it does look like the Joker. It looks like he's wearing a string tie. They just gave him a brown suit and, a Caucasian skin tone as opposed to the white pallor. But it's a cool image, too. It's a really neat illustration.
Tells you everything you need to know. Then there's another there's another ad about home recording, which is only for nerds, of course. And then finally, there is it's basically podcasting in 1940. And then the final thing is there's a pinup. Which you can cut out and frame, which how many kids did, ruining their valuable Batman number one. It's got Batman and Robin standing there beaming. They are beaming with smile. They are so happy. Batman, not mysterious much anymore.
No.
This is Batman, yours for bigger and better thrills, Batman. And then Robin says, and that goes double for me, Robin. And they're standing there, and they're just, you know, these are your best pals, these two.
Yeah, this was – what I also like that about it is that the artist – and it is believed to be Bob Kane who actually did this – is took went through the trouble of giving Batman and Robin different handwriting. You know, that's – I like that little detail that it actually is – it's as if they do exist and they did sign this separately because it even says, I think – there's a little mini house ad earlier in the book that says, hey, kids, check out the back cover. You know, because you guys are so supportive. Here's our, here's a pinup that you get of Batman and Robin, and it's autographed, which I think is really funny that it's autographed.
I wonder how many copies of Batman number one were marred by a kid cutting this out, putting it on his wall, not knowing that Batman number one would be worth $500,000 someday.
Right.
So, and then we get the back cover to the actual Famous First Edition, which is a pinup taken from Batman number one, slightly redrawn, retouched a little here and there, but it's reversed of its Batman swinging on a rope.
Right.
And the one little weird detail to this whole book of Famous First Edition is at the time, DC put out hardcover editions. Right. Of these Famous First Editions by Lyle Stewart, which is a separate publisher, and they were done with – they were just the same cover except with a hard cover and then a plastic wrapping around like you would have in school books and stuff. And even though this hard cover of Batman number one supposedly was it was supposed to be done like all the rest of them, even the Overstreet Price Guide pretty much concludes that this – that there is no hardcover of this book because no one has ever been able to find it. I've never been able to find it. I've been collecting these for years. I have the hardcovers to all the Famous First Editions, but I have never been able to find a Batman number one. And even one time, I was contacted by a woman who said, I saw your website. I have the hardcover edition of Batman number one, and I'll sell it to you. And I was like, wow, really? And I said, well, how much do you want for it? She says, well, it's really beat up, but I'll sell it to you for like $15. And I bought it sight unseen, and I got it, and it's not the hardcover.
It was this?
It was the soft cover, yeah. And so I wrote to her, and I was like, lady, what the hell? And she pretended to misunderstand what she was – I don't know whether I got ripped off or not, but, Crime Stopper tips, kids. Don't send money into a book you haven't seen. So as far as we know that there is no hardcover of this. It just doesn't exist, even though DC claims or whatever that it was published like – they did for Superman number one, not Superman number one, Action number one, Detective 27, Wonder Woman, but no one's ever been able to find it.
Which is amazing when you consider just how, I mean, Batman, wildly popular, obviously, but just how important of all of the Famous First Editions, of course, there's Action Comics number one. And of course, based on your fandom, you're going to say, well, no, actually, the Wiz Comics is more important or the Sensation Comics. Okay, fine. Okay, I'm a Batman fan, so I'm inherently biased on this. But because of the overall, how much goes on in this book that we just talked about, stuff that we're still seeing today, 78 years later, on different levels, it really is remarkable that of all the ones for them not to do would have been this one. Because to me, this would have been one of the first ones that they did. So you can only conjecture as to why it never happened.
Yeah, it's very strange. And it drove me nuts because I kept thinking I just couldn't find it. right. You know, and then eventually, again, even the press guy was like, look, we really don't even think this exists. So it stands unique. But again, it's a great book. It absolutely deserved to be reprinted. You know, DC's going to go back and dip into their history and reprint the first appearances of all their major characters. You absolutely have to have Batman number one. It's a seminal book. You know, just for it being, again, like I said, just because it's Batman number one, it's important. Let alone, it's the first appearance of two of his probably his two most famous villains, I would say.
Yeah, I would say so.
You know, I mean certainly the Joker's Joker.
The Joker's his biggest rival, and Catwoman is the woman, you know, who has been, you know, his star-crossed companion, if you will, you know, going on. I mean, they're going to get married, or at least they have a wedding date set, let's put it that way. But, I mean, if you're talking about the biggest adversary of his life is the Joker, and the biggest woman in his life is Catwoman, and his best buddy is Robin, who this is really his first real adventures beyond his origin. Yeah, I mean, come on. What more do you want?
Yeah. And if the rumors are to be believed that they're making a Joker solo movie, that means within a short period of time, both characters, both of these villains will have had their own movie.
Right.
Which is, I mean, the less said about Catwoman, the movie, the better. But nevertheless, that's how famous these villains are, is that they both had their own movies, for Pete's sake. So it's pretty amazing. So it's a good book, Famous First Edition, F5, Batman number one. So, Dan, well, thank you so much for wanting to talk about it. You've been bugging me about this for the longest time.
Oh, I have.
Every email, I got behind the curtains here a little, folks. Every email that I have with Dan regarding an unrelated business, he would end with, "When are we doing Famous First Edition number one?" I'm like, I gotta get to. I know it's Christmas. I got other things. He's like, "Okay, great." But by the way, when are we getting to Batman number one? We're here.
It is so true. I used to keep this in a stack with the other two treasuries, along with a Riddler comic book, because I was always bothered that there was a Riddler. That villain's treasury didn't have a Riddler story in it.
Right.
And I felt like this was my Batman pile, that really this is all you needed. And all this time I'm thinking, we got to talk about this. So thank you for finally yielding to my pestering, because, yes, I everything that Rob just told you is 100% true.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't take it as that he was threatening my real retro cinema columns, but I also
no.
I do. We both are from New Jersey, and we know how that stuff rolls, you know.
So,
exactly. It'd be a real nice column here. It'd be same if something happened to it. So anyway, Dan, thank you so much for coming on again. I always love talking to you. And where can people find your work on the internet? It's not that they don't already know, but please go ahead.
13th Dimension, 13thdimension.com. Yes, follow us on Twitter and on Facebook and all of that stuff. And if you like what we were just talking about, that's a lot of what I write about. Rob, of course, also contributes to the site with his real retro cinema columns and other things on occasion as well. Just recently doing something, stepping into his Aquaman world, doing a really nice tribute to Steve Skeets and all of that. But if you're reading comics today, you'll find that here. And if you're reading comics from yesterday, you'll find that here. So pay us a visit.
All right. Very cool. Thank you so much. Again, thanks for coming on. I always love talking to you. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Stay tuned for some commercials and for other podcasts. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Hi, this is Batman. Whenever I lose my memory, I head over to the BatmanUniverse.net and check out the podcast, Bat Books for Beginners. The Bat Books for Beginners podcast breaks down and analyzes all of my adventures so I can remember how to get to the Batcave, which Robin I'm working with, and where I parked the Batmobile. Chris and Jerry, the hosts of Bat Books for Beginners, are honest about how well I'm serving the citizens of Gotham. Sometimes too honest, I'll have to talk to them about that. If you wake up one morning and think you might be Batman and have just lost your memories, go over to the BatmanUniverse.net or iTunes and check out Bat Books for Beginners. Now, if I could just figure out who this old man cleaning the Batcave is, that would be great. I asked my friend Scott Snyder and he didn't know. Don't be a supervillain. Visit thebatmanuniverse.net and listen to Bat Books for Beginners, also on iTunes. You'll be glad you did.
Bat Books for Beginners is part of the batmanuniverse.net Bat Family of Podcasts. Don't listen to Bat Books for Beginners when operating heavy machinery or juggling. If you listen to Bat Books for Beginners for more than 4 hours, call your doctor. Bat Books for Beginners is part of a balanced diet.
Hello, Paul. Hello. I am Dr. Herfenstaffner. Come in, please. Take a seat. What can I do for you today?
I can't sleep. I can't focus on anything. The only thing I can think about is, like, DC events.
DC events? As in the comic books? DC events?
Yes. The comic book events.
Ooh, interesting. Are we talking things like Crisis on Infinite Earths?
Yeah, totally. That one, yeah.
Infinite Crisis?
Yeah, that one too.
Oh, very, very. Invasion, maybe?
Yeah, definitely.
The Genesis?
Not so much.
No? Oh. Okay, well, I think it's really good if you talk about the things that are troubling you in your life, so maybe you should do a podcast about this obsession.
What do you call this obsession? What do you think it is?
I think you're a unique case. I've not seen anything like this before in my office. I'm going to suggest that you have what we call DC-OCD.
What? DC-OCD?
You are obsessive and compulsive about your DC events. I think you should talk it out, get it out of your system via a podcast. I will help you, my friend. We shall do a podcast together about your DC-OCD.
Oh, okay.
I won't even charge you for it.
Awesome. I don't think I can claim you on benefits.
Yeah, it's good.
When should we start?
I'll get back to you on that. I'll check my timetable.
Cool.
And we're back with some listener feedback, talking about episode 20, which was Christmas with the Superheroes with Chris Franklin. And email-wise from firewarnpodcast.com, David S. Gutierrez says, just call them Christmas shows already. Great show, fellas. I never tire hearing my bestie and Steve Franks enjoy comics, something my blackened chest pump no longer allows. Thank you, David. Merry Christmas, belatedly. Michael Lane from the Comics in the Golden Age podcast says, great episode. In addition to just being a sucker for Christmas stories, I really love this treasury for how much Golden Age content they put in it. Readers who got into comics in the 70s or later often look down on Golden Age art as crude or primitive, but I've always felt this treasury made a great case against that view. As you noted, seeing the art of each of these Golden Age stories enlarged worked really well with these particular stories and made it look great. Especially H.G. Peter, who often had his art overshadowed by the very, very text-heavy approach of Marston's writing. Yeah, the lettering was great, but the text was very dense. I imagine even Roy Thomas would probably look at it and think, wow, that's a little much. Yeah, Michael, I agree. I really have been enjoying looking at H.G. Peter stuff at this large size because it deserves it, because it is so dense. And when you get to see it at a larger size, really does you really get to appreciate just how much you put into it. It's amazing stuff. And yes, the Wonder Woman stories are a little text-heavy. Ado Boznar says, man, I'll have to wait yet another year to see some love for one of those Marvel Xmas treasuries. And probably not the one with the snowball fight. Oh well. Ido, I promise. Next year. Enjoy this episode anyway. I love the Silent Night of the Batman. It's definitely a classic. And you've got me quite intrigued about the Superman and Wonder Woman stories. In the latter case in particular, I'm coming closer to pulling the trigger on getting one of those books that collects some Golden Age Wonder Woman stories. As to your discussion of the Sandman story in Kirby's art, I have to say I think you guys kind of gave short shrift to Joe Simon. It's my understanding that in the early stories, Simon not only co-plotted them and wrote the dialogue, but also inked Kirby's pencils and sometimes even finished Kirby's breakdowns. Any story in which Simon did the complete art, you realize how much he contributed to the art and his collaborations with Kirby. Yeah, I think that's true. You know, both Chris and I, you can't help but talk about Jack Kirby. But yeah, Joe Simon did bring a lot to that partnership. And so we apologize if we didn't quite get into that enough. And Martin Gray from Too Dangerous from a Girl says, what a terrific episode. I don't have this issue, but I was able to read the Wonder Woman, House of Mysteries, Sandman and Superman stories in the Fantastic, a DC Universe Christmas trade from 2000, the one with the superhero gift-wrapped cover. And yes, that fir tree story is weird even for Marston and Peter. Have extra fun with this one by reading the Nazis dialogue out loud. I think we have enough of that going on right now, Martin. And he says, now, Chris, you've done a wonderful job on 12 Christmas podcasts this year, but as a family man, you likely want to spend more time with your loved ones. So you should maybe turn down a half dozen next year and give some other poor sod a chance. Oops, did I say that out loud? Martin, I promise, we'll get you on a Christmas episode of some show on the network next year. I also got an email from someone named Rafe York, who says, I was reading – he found some really interesting little bit of trivia here. He says, I was reading Weird Western Tales number 57, which was on the newsstands April 26, 1979, according to Mike's Amazing World. And in the Answer Man feature, Barbara Zachas responded to a question asking about the next Famous First Edition, saying Superboy number one will probably be the next FFE. Do you have any knowledge or insight into why this edition was scrapped? No, Rafe, I don't. In fact, I don't even know of that. I never saw that little bit. I read the Answer Man column pretty regularly. In fact, always, every time. But I don't remember that answer. I have to find a copy of that issue and look for that answer. I'll maybe even ask Barbara Zachas about it. I'm friends with him on Facebook. That sounds really intriguing. I'm guessing Superboy number one was done in conjunction with the movie because anything Superman was big. But yeah, I had no idea that they were even going to do another Famous First Edition other than the Superman number one they did. So that's a great find, Rafe. I appreciate it. And he also sends an email saying, my dream treasury would be a collection of Matt Baker romance stories. That's a cool idea. I like that. And the character I'd like to see get his or her own treasury would be Black Canary by Alex Toth. Well, you know, that's music to Ryan Daly's ears, obviously. And yes, the Alex Toth Black Canary story at a large size would be amazing to see, as we know from the Super Friends treasury and other treasuries, that Alex Toth's work looked great no matter what size you did it. But the Black Canary, those two Black Canary stories are particularly great, so that would have been a great pick. So great picks, Rafe, and thank you so much for the email. And finally, I want to thank the people who retweeted over on Twitter the post for the podcast to help get the show noticed. So I want to thank Supermates Pod, Classic JLA, Zumika Nori, The 108 Sage, Rolled Spine, Ted Killington, Justice Trek, It's Plastic Man, Whole Truthy, Joel W. Is God, Greg Z. Rosenboom, RMR, TV Bum 2, Slang Word, Dr. Multiverse, Fellow Penoria, is that how you say it? Ryan Daly 01, Comics in the GA, Dr. Ann 70, DC Cons Retreat, Comic Reflection, Once Upon a Geek, Firestorm Fam, Rick Gross DRG, Longbox Crusade, and Coffee and Comics Blog. So again, thanks everybody for the retweets. It helps get the show noticed. We need all the help we can get, obviously. So again, thanks everybody for listening. Thanks so much for Dan Greenfield, again, for Come Up Guy talking about Batman. That was a fun episode, and we will see you next week. So until then, go big or go home.
Deep in the cavernous basement of this house is a strange, dimly lighted secret bat cave. Hidden headquarters of Batman, America's number one crime fighter. Batman and his two-fisted assistant, Robin, the Boy Wonder. Wherever crime raises its ugly head to strike, Batman and Robin strike also. Columbia Pictures presents the incomparable Batman and Robin. The famous serial that has amazed Bat fans around the world. 15 thrill-packed chapters. Playboy Bruce Wayne and his ward Dick Grayson are ready at a moment's notice to become the indomitable aces of courage. Batman and Robin. Going wherever danger leads them, taking superhuman risks against incredible odds. You'll gasp, you'll cheer as Batman and Robin battle for justice in the adventure of the century. These pulse-pounding episodes will rivet you to your seat. Don't fail to see Batman and Robin.